The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
How did we get here? And where have we come? And where are we? These are great questions for classical Christian educators. I'd like to just have you think about something that you're given the opportunity to give record to in your booklets. At the very start of those booklets, you see a place where you can write down takeaways. I don't know if you've been writing those down, but if I were to ask you to just shout out a few of the takeaways that you've gotten at this convention so far, I'm sure that they would be very, very many and very, very interesting. One of my big takeaways is requires no words. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah, see, a couple of you know what I'm talking about. Bruce Etter's the Dostoevsky principle. And I think I know how to explain it, articulate it verbally because of his clear presentation yesterday. So I want to give you something to take away. And it's going to require that you write it down unless you turn it into an acronym, and then you can think about the acronym on your way out. I'm going to repeat this principle over and over again. And it requires you to think about a word that may be relatively unfamiliar to you. And here's the takeaway from today's presentation. The heuristic is the takeaway. The heuristic is the takeaway. I believe that the heuristic, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric in particular, as a combination under the trivium, is the takeaway from classical Christian education in general. The student takes that away with them, meaning that the trivium is equipment, intellectual equipment for discovering new things. And so I have in my title, it's not up there right now, the idea that we want as teachers to continually be in a position of discovering something new as we seek to teach those new things to our students. So the heuristic is the takeaway. If you want an acronym, it's HIT, H-I-T. Heuristic is, it's not as good as this. Dostoevsky principle. But that's my takeaway. Now, if you want to see the long version of that, page 2 in your handout has something that's near and dear to Mr. Baker, right, Emma? I've got a couple of students, a chart, right? Am I right? Charts. Mr. Baker and his charts, what's with that today? Enough with the charts, they say. When they're not listening to me. That's right, if you haven't got the handout, there's a 3-page handout on the chair. So that's the long version of the technique that I'd like to encourage or exhort us to adopt internally into the way that we see teaching in classical Christian education. Not just teaching writing, not just teaching speaking, but everything. That's the across the entire classical curriculum part of my presentation. So my presentation today is one part exhortation and one part application. The exhortation is somewhat theoretical about creativity in particular, as it applies to the progymnasmata. And the application are a few examples that help you see this chart in closer detail so that you can take it away with you and perhaps apply it in a relatively unlimited fashion in the future. Now, the source of these contemplations today for me particularly is an opportunity that I'm availing myself of to write some curriculum for a new venture called Confluence Courseware. I've been manning a booth upstairs in the service of that new initiative. And I've been asked to write a series of texts in rhetoric and senior thesis. And I've collected all three of them under a title that encompasses the spirit of what I'm saying today. And the title is Faithful Invention. Faithful Invention. The idea is that we are faithful to the classical tradition, but we are, in rhetorical terms, inventing, discovering something new all the time. So it's kind of an oxymoronic title. Faithful, meaning that we're tied to the past, and we don't want to become untethered from it. But we're also exploring new things all the time as teachers. Faithful invention. Now here's our big Greek word. Go ahead, yawn. I just saw Bruce yawn, but you know, he had a nap today. So, how many of you have seen this word and begin to yawn when you see it? Another big Greek word, why are we so committed to it? I won't ask the question, how many of you who know this word still don't know what really what it means? The opposite side of this is, you know what? I pretty much have this done. I've been looking at this word for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and I'm wondering inside why we need to go here again. And those two possible responses are part of my motivation for speaking to you today. And this brings to mind the relationship between some things that Quintilian had to say, known as the father of education, and something very near and dear to every Pennsylvanian's heart. You'll see a live sample on my podium right here. You know what this is? Right here. The Pennsylvania state animal is the white-tailed deer. Pennsylvania state drink is milk, which in Pittsburgh we pronounce as milk. The Pennsylvania state airplane is a Piper Cub. The patron saint of Pennsylvania is Bruce Etter. And the Pennsylvania state plant is Crown Vetch. Right there. Crown Vetch. If you drive around in Pennsylvania, you see it all the time. The Pennsylvania state motto is virtue, liberty, independence. But I want to talk about Crown Vetch because that's what Quintilian is talking about thousands of years ago. 2,000 of years ago, Quintilian talks about our topic through this plant. Listen to this quotation. He's thinking about the question, how is rhetoric of virtue to be acquired by a student, and how is rhetoric of virtue to be taught by a teacher who must possess it him or herself first before passing it on to a student? Listen to this amazing statement from 2,000 years ago. There is an unprofitable imitation of art, which is neither good nor bad, but merely involves a useless expenditure of labor, reminding one of the man who shot a continuous stream of vetch seeds from a distance through the eye of a needle without ever missing his aim, and was rewarded by Alexander, who was a witness of the display, with the present of a bushel of vetch seeds. A most appropriate reward. It is to such men that I would compare those who spend their whole time at the expense of much study and energy in composing declamations, which they aim at making as unreal as possible. A useless expenditure. Do you hear how Quintilian, already in the history of classical education, is looking at some of his peers and saying, you are engaged in a useless expenditure. It's pretty amazing. It's a 4-volume book in the Loeb edition, and it's filled with observations of this sort, where he's concerned that his fellow rhetoric teachers, in this case, are off the track and taking their students off the track. And keep in mind that declamation is the culmination of the progymnasmata. I'm going to talk about that word, for those of you who are a little bit unfamiliar with its meaning, in the first major point that's coming up. So I teach rhetoric. I like to ask my students to identify the question. Remember the Greek word, Emma? The stasis that we're going to address in our presentation. So the question at the heart what I'm exhorting us to think about today is, can many of the appropriated resources of classical origin devolve into the same state of uselessness that Quintilian decries in the first century AD? If they haven't actually devolved into this state of uselessness, can they be taught in such a way that they are perceived as being relatively useless? It's a pretty important question. I think you can agree. Behind this question is the assumption that we as teachers of the trivium want to receive this gift, this threefold gift of the trivium, faithfully, but extend it creatively. Otherwise, it becomes like that vetch seed shooter who is rewarded with what? Another bushel of vetch seed. That's sort of like a baseball player who can hit a home run every time. And as soon as he runs out of balls, what does he get as his reward? More baseballs. It's an end in itself. No. So we need to learn how to let this gift reside in us as teachers before we can pass along to students. We must not pass any of these gifts on as unprofitable imitations of art, and in particular, to become averse to the progymnasmata as formulas that must be served as they have been received in their original state. In the right hands, a rich use of classical resources like these will not be given to that concern. The question is, how do we make ours the right hands as teachers? And my answer to that is, our discovery process, down to the nitty-gritty assignment generation that we perform, needs to be driven by a psychology of abiding by the spirit of the classical resources as opposed to the letter. Now, I'm not alone in saying this. I think there are several people, I know for sure there are several people whose names you've known for a long time who are saying similar things. So as I said, the first part of my presentation is exhortation. But I want to show you how the heuristic that I've developed, which I hope to develop even further in the work that I'm writing on, is a takeaway that might be somewhat unique for us and useful as we apply it in our teaching. So again, let me state the issue. How do we preserve and perpetuate the things that we are appropriating, these priceless resources of classical origin, while also unleashing a creativity in us as teachers that is an aspect of virtue? We have to do it first in ourselves and then in our students. How do we preserve and perpetuate the best resources of classical origin, like the progymnasmata, like Quintilian's declamation, without allowing them to degenerate into uselessness or use them in such a way that we contribute to that impression? And I'm saying that the contrast between abiding by them in the spirit as opposed to the letter is very important. So, let's move on. The spirit of the progymnasmata. By the way, the Greek word is pronounced a couple of different ways by people. I have some friends in my church who teach classical languages, and they use the soft G, the progymnasmata. Some people use the hard G. I may go back and forth with it. Two sentences because of habit. So please forgive me if that stumbles you. I want to ask you a question, given the title of this slide. And by the way, notice that the picture here is one of a ladder. The progymnasmata mean four exercises, not the number four, but the idea of coming before. So they are exercises that precede the study of rhetoric proper. And they are intended to begin in grammar school, so in our culture at the age of five, and continue all the way through to the student's entry into rhetoric proper. What is the spirit of that process as contrasted or compared with the letter of that process? Now, if you want to see the letter of that process, you'll see the titles in your chart under the first column. You see the 14 exercises. And each one of those is characterized by a formula. But I want to ask you a question before I get into the particulars of the formulas, because I'm not going to describe the formulas. I'm not really even going to teach much about how to do the progymnasmata by the letter. I want to show you the result that I have come up with by looking at them in terms of the spirit of the progymnasmata. What is really going on in them? How would a classical teacher in that age have seen rhetorical training within that flow? But I want to ask you a question. Not a question about teaching, but a question about theology. I'm not going to ask you to answer it out loud, but what is your biblical Christian theology of living in the Spirit? You know, Paul talks about the Spirit versus the letter. How would you, in a nutshell, describe your theological understanding of living in the Spirit? It's a pretty big, almost nebulous question, isn't it? Well, by analogy, the teacher and the curriculum creator, the person who's writing prompts or assignments for his or her students, is always negotiating that tension in classical Christian education between the letter of the classical that they've received as almost an antiquarian preservationist agenda. We do this thing because it's classical. Maybe we don't think too much about how or why we could do it in a contemporary way. And we put that into tension with the spirit of the classical as a lively resource for the present and the future. And so the way that I talk about this tension is with the phrase original appropriation. Original appropriation. I found some chapstick. And you know, there's lots of chapstick out there. This is the classic original. Right? So it's an oxymoron, right? Classic means it's there and established. Original means it's, in terms of creativity, it means somebody's come up with something new. So we're talking about that tension, faithful invention. How does this pairing work? We want to appropriate and teach our students to appropriate the classical resources in a new and original way. So the original, the classical resource, is rendered proper. Notice that proper is etymologically related to appropriate. Original things are rendered proper because they are tethered to the classical. But the classical is rendered original because it's an extension of the old into something new. There's not an either or in this movement. Now, back to what the progymnasmata are. Progymnasmata in classical education, a graduated series of successive exercises. You see the 14 on the left-hand side of the chart. They're designed to prepare students to study rhetoric in earnest and with considerable focus and breadth. To prepare them for full-sized essays and speeches, which in those days were referred to as declamation. Declamation being kind of a contest experience, much like our forensics experiences that we have many students participating in our day. Along the way, through this series of 14 exercises, the entire rhetorical canon is implicitly embedded in the students' experience without them knowing what they're learning. So they're learning invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery, without the teacher saying, "You're studying invention right now." It's just happening. And one of the things I like to point out is that the canon, I'm spouting off here, the five offices of the canon are kind of turned upside down. Because at the grammar level, at the bottom level of the ladder, they're learning how to memorize things and to deliver them, to stand up and do show and tell kinds of activities. And they don't know that they're studying the great canon of memory and delivery, pronuntiatio in the Latin, hupocrisis in the Greek. But they are learning. So there's this sense of implicitness that is being acquired by catching as opposed to being taught explicitly as they move up this ladder. Another correlation is that in the classical world, the authors of the progymnasmata, there are many of them, Aphthonius is the most important one, they tend to make correlations between the exercises and the three rhetorical genres, political, legal, and ceremonial, deliberative, forensic, epidictic. So they, if you were to look at that left-hand column, you'd see that they make direct correlations between some of those activities and what the student, as a future adult, will need to know if they're in the courtroom. We'll have all this stuff that they're storing into themselves that will kind of bubble up out when they get into these adult situations. And they won't even remember where they got it. It'll just be there. Which is an interesting part of the classical education philosophy, right? But the student doesn't have to know what they're learning explicitly until a certain age. Now, these exercises survive in today's teaching throughout the Western world without being called by this name. But sometimes the exercises have a direct correlation to other names. What I want to ask about them is, how do we appropriate them in an original way so that we are neither appropriating them directly only, that's the letter side of our appropriation, or going too far with our creativity so that the classic is lost? So to explain this contrast with some analogies, if my job is to be the executor of a will, you're going to want me to operate as if my brain is in a cubicle. A very strict category. That's the direct appropriation of the art, the science of executing the will. But there are lots of other activities that are administrative, rhetorical, and other areas that you want the classical resources of my training to retain, to obtain, but you also want me to be creative, to be able to draw from the possibilities of that situation. Now, one of the analogies that I thought of, that some of you will identify with, is a contemporary phenomenon that we call the craft beer phenomenon. If any of you know anything about this, we see that the ancient art of brewing has diffused into these multiple manifestations to the point where creativity has gotten a little bit out of control in some of our people. So I was discussing with somebody last night the idea of a saison that is flavored with hibiscus. Sort of like taking these flowers and putting them in beer and saying, well, a new variety. Everybody, that's going a little bit too far that side of the continuum. So you see the tension between a creativity that serves the classic, which is good, and a creativity that is served by or informed by the classical. We're talking about a continuum that we want to maintain balance in. I find this tension in Psalm 119, 1 through 11. Your decrees are my heritage forever. They are the joy of my heart. I incline my heart to perform your statutes forever to the end. So you see the relationship between the eternal, what we would refer to analogically as the classical heritage, this inheritance, this gift that has landed in our hands by providence, customs, traditions, and the need to perform, to incline joyfully my heart to a performance of those things in this situation. It's that tension, faithful invention. We need to see that we can have it both ways. We must have it both ways. In an oxymoronic synthesis between the original appropriation and the creative appropriation. So I define this solution to the problem that I stated earlier as the original appropriation of the tools of lifelong learning that were given to us by God, by providence, by grace, through civilization's ancient arts, especially the trivia. Now, let's talk about dip. That's my exhortation to creativity in the context of classical Christian education. We'll talk about an example. And this is an example from just this week. because I was trying to come up with a good pair of illustrations of how I begin to do this, trying to do this. And this example I'm getting ready to go into is included as a writing speaking prompt in the text. But it should be the first alliteracy, reducing traditions of truth. So here's how this thing happens. I'm walking you through a process that I went through, attempting to live by these rules. You see, this happened to me this year. This is the one from making my mom cry. Okay. I was thinking about ants. Because a long time ago, I didn't go to school in this world. I used to give my students an assignment, and I said, the muscle strength of an ant, the astronomical feature called the great tractor, and some passage in Ecclesiastes. Make a speech. So I was thinking about how I might revisit that prompt. Drew Flowers is the best speech. Never forget. And as I was looking at that, I don't have my Wi-Fi connected, but as I was looking at that, I clicked on this thing. So check my scientific facts. And by the way, notice that the end part of my title is across the entire classical curriculum. There is no humanities STEM split. The quadrillion is the trunk. You can have all kinds of STEM branches on that. Seven liberal arts on the trunk. So I'm trying to think, okay, I may have some science teachers who are interested in that. The end of my title brings us across the entire classical curriculum. It's a neat. I'm trying to think of science. How can a science teacher use rhetoric in their class? So I'm researching that,
and I come across something else. An article in a scientific website about how babies recognize faces before they're born.
That's Malia, my great niece, and that's me, making a funny face. I should tell you, she was baptized at some point. That's what this picture fit. One of the things about her is that she does that all the time. Right? Mom? You pick her up, she's just. That's like she's been practicing for 9 months. And it's a scientific fact. She just stares at me. She's making all kinds of faces. She doesn't change position.
I'm actually a little bit worried about it. I'm hoping that she can. And so as I'm thinking about that and these principles that I'm trying to talk about today, I end up coming up with this writing prompt.
And to boil all of this writing prompt down into how it applies to what I'm talking about, is that you notice that it's an adaptation of the original prototype to a level that is a little bit higher than some of the exercises that are included. Think of that again. But it's also a combination of several of those exercises into one writing. Notice how many there are. Reputation, confirmation, personation, and description. I have to read this later to see what I'm talking about. But I give myself the liberty to do that because I'm trying to live by the spirit of Virgin Mountain, not the letter. I'm not just walking up that ladder every time because that's the way they did it when Anthonius wrote it out. I'm actually looking at the ladder from a distance, which is what I'm going to call a macro for this moment. I'm saying, I'm going to put this thing together in a new way. We'll see what happens. Maybe it'll fall in space. But I can be a science teacher and ask my students to perform rhetorically, and in the process, they're becoming Christian scientists. I have to make sure that I put some distance between the two words. They're scientifically minded Christians in their persuasive attempts to support a thesis that the fetus is a human person.
So you see how this example manifests what I'm exhorting us to try. The paradox here is that original appropriation is so tied to the classical that it both sees rhetoric as the core of the trivium, but also discovery as something that I'm permitted to practice as I learn to write assignments. So if rhetoric is the end and therefore the core of the trivium from the roots on up, from grammar on up, I stole this picture from a classical Christian website. Maybe you've seen it before. I don't know if you don't like this. But I like the organic metaphor of the tree. Rhetoric being the blossoming of the tree. So if rhetoric is the end of the trivium and its core, then the trivium, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, can be seen as something that's already embedded in the progymnasmata, and the classical people who put that together knew that. They were seeing that too. And so I have depicted that in our chart all the way over on the right-hand side of the chart. Page 2. And if we have time, we'll look at this in more detail. But you can see that after the proverb, where that first upward-pointing arrow appears, we have begun to move from the grammar level into the dialectic level. This is thinking of the trivium in terms of stages, which is a legitimate thing. Sarah's idea of the trivium is the stages that are legitimate, but I prefer to add to that, the trivium on modes of learning. People have been talking about that just in this very room yesterday. Tim Gurney was talking about that. He was citing Chris Perrin in his book many years ago. That the trivium, all of the elements of the trivium are present at all times, from the bottom up, just more or less. So that idea is present in this chart. And so after we get to refutation and confirmation, we're right in that dialectic, that set of dialectic skills, which I refer to as interrogating and testing. And then as you move down where it says rhetoric proper begins, the exercises are moving closer and closer to the purely rhetorical. Now, as we're moving through this, and shouldn't it actually be reversed? Shouldn't we have this from the bottom up? The table is at the bottom, and rhetoric is at the top, like the leaves on the tree. So as we're moving down in terms of this chart, we're taking everything that we've learned with. It's not like we, okay, well, I know how to tell a story, check. I don't ever tell a story again. Right? It's being imbibed, hopefully permanently, as we move through. And I want us as teachers to see how to play with the fluidity of that continuum from bottom up in the assignment creation process. So if the first two premises of my argument are acceptable, then I'm saying that heuresis, remember, what's the takeaway? The heuristic is the takeaway. Meaning that the tool, if I dare say so, the tool that's depicted in a chart like this, I put it in here, and I begin to see ways of applying this approach to creating assignments every single day in our teaching experience. Because I'm a classical Christian educator, I'm driven by the trivium at every step. That's the way I see assignments universally. I don't have to get outside the trivium. No, what I mean by that is not that the book, The Liberal Arts Tradition by Jane, Clark and Jane. Those are actually their names, by the way, Clark and Jane. That book starts before the trivium with piety and gymnastics and music. A, arts, and goes beyond that into quadrivium, and theology and philosophy, that more than just three things going on there. What I'm saying is that in that trivium level, the way that we see our assignment generation and discover ways to teach and assign things is the key to our teaching. And I'm saying it's rhetorical teaching because rhetoric is the top of the trivium. Now let's look at what heuresis means. We're at our second Roman numeral in our outline. Now that we've seen what the issue is that I'm trying to address, and a little look into what the spirit of the progymnasmata, which I'm saying stands in for everything classical, I use the phrase resources of classical origin. Now that we've seen those two things, let's talk about heuresis in particular. What is a heuristic? Well, a heuristic is something that helps me to see something else. Or in particular, helps me to discover something else. The word literally means discovery, and we get an exclamation from it. Same word. One of the implications of that idea for us, that I've been talking about all along, notice the motto at the bottom of California, the city in California, Eureka, proud past, promising future. I didn't know that they were talking about the same thing I'm talking about today in my talk, but there it is on their sign. It's as if we're moving from the east to the west instead of from the west to who knows where. And sometimes we ask that in the 21st century, right? We're kind of in a post-Western, at a post-Western precipice in society where all sorts of weird things are happening. What's next, right? So heuresis is about discovering things, and in the case of the classical resources, in such a way that it synthesizes the values of the past with my aspirations to the future. Practically speaking, what this has led me to think about as I look ahead to the writing of my textbook material, my courseware material, is how can I concentrate all 14 of these exercises into a grade or a level appropriated collection. Right? So we're not seeing them now as grammar, dialectic, rhetoric, term stages. I'm going to take all of them and make them a dialectic collection. So fable, narrative, cry for the dialectic. I've got to upgrade it. I've got to update it to a different level of person. So we concentrate all of them into a smaller collection. When I do that, I'm going to allow the art of rhetoric to then zoom in on the things that are taught in each of those exercises and explode them into rhetorical assignments that incrementally walk the student through each of its sub-parts. So for example, the kriya, that's the third thing I'm doing, has 8 parts to it. You may have a memory. Phrase, paraphrase, pause, contrast, testimony of the meaning to break down in my memory. I can't remember all of them. So if I'm concentrating all of these into one and I've got the time to do it, what if I talk about how to really support a thesis statement that heavily relies on testimony? Which is something that students are going to need to learn how to do when they're writing research. Using citations and things like that. So I'm at that point where I say, I'm going to explode you with the granularity of this assignment. So I'm kind of doing 2 things at once. Collecting, diving in, and opening it up so that I can explore with all sorts of ways to come up with writing and speaking assignments. And I'm exhorting all teachers, regardless of discipline, subject matter, to climb aboard the Trivium train. The Trivium train goes through all the classrooms and it's got a people magnet on it. There actually are a couple schools that have that many faculty. Not that many. And all of them are using the rhetorical heuristic. Now, let's get technical. What is a heuristic? You can use the word heuristic in the field of science, in scientific fields that I don't know very much about. So scientists will talk about tools of discovery and new things scientifically. What we're talking about here is an artistic heuristic. The word heuresis appears in Aristotle's rhetoric as in any other Greek rhetoric as invention or discovery. I'll never forget the day in Lynchburg, Virginia, when our school was meeting at a place called Jones Memorial Library. They all remember this. And I walked
It's one of the old buildings that has stuff carved into blocks outside the building. And they have the seven liberal arts carved into stone. And they don't have invention, they have the word discovery. And I would take the whole class out there and take a look and say, look at that. You're part of something that's been around for a long time. And they thought it was important enough to put it into granite at the top of the building. When we go back inside, they would continue to be bored by the class. A little field trip.
So what a heuristic does is it provides an intellectual bridge from the known to the unknown. And so, to paraphrase on the great vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, I say thanks, and many thanks, for that bridge to nowhere. Because I'm going to make it be a bridge to somewhere that has never been gone to before, at least in my class. I'm going to discover something new with this heuristic. Now let's get technical. In rhetoric, a heuristic discovers really a small collection of things that are deceiving the sentence, short of the list. We've got Latin names for it. Rhetorical heuristics is about learning how to identify or discover my precise subject, the issue that I'm treating, in a situation with a particular audience. What I'm going to argue in light of my purpose and how I'm going to prove it. Res, stasis, thesis, verbum. That's all that rhetoric is about. This is what we call the rhetorical process diagram. And so a rhetorical heuristic helps me to identify all of these.
The most interesting part of this that we probably miss the most is the second part. In my senior thesis classes, I often say, all of you guys want to jump from race to thesis and forget about stasis. So we don't think about rhetoric enough as a situated audience-specific enterprise. And this goes back to the spirit-letter contrast that I was talking about a moment ago. Because the spirit of Projan Nazmata is to apply my discovery process to this class, this subject, and the new way. The same thing applies to when students learn how to trade. Who's their audience? What's the situation?
What's the issue? Which is what the word stasis means there. Now, in order to understand this in terms of rhetoric as an art, as a heuristic art, I want to share with you
finally something that we talk about in rhetoric,
which is that rhetoric really is classified in three ways. It's a theoretical art, a productive art, and a practical art, all at once. Theoretically, it helps me to see. That's the heuristic part. But artistically, it helps me to make something. So if I'm a sculptor, you know that old adage about Michelangelo, look at a rough chunk of marble and see faith. Just see it. And then he starts hammering away and he makes it. And now when he's done making it, the David that he saw is probably not there. But the greater the artist, the closer what I see to what I've made gets. And so I see David in there, and by the time I'm done, it looks like the David I saw in that chunk of marble.
Now, the important thing about this for us as teachers of rhetoric or people who are teaching rhetorically is that there's a third part of this, and that is that rhetoric is intended to do something in the end. And the problem is that what it's intended to do is to persuade audiences, and we really don't have any direct control over what that does. We have direct control over how we use the heuristic to see and over how we use what we've seen to make. But whether or not the audience is persuaded, we don't know. Why is there a picture of a blown up building on the slide? This is my analogy. May 7, 1999, the Kosovo Company. Remember, Bill Clinton was the president. It was a direct hit, and that's the building. The problem was, It wasn't the enemy. It was the Chinese embassy. Anybody remember that? It was a perfect success in terms of making a bombing sortie. But it was a total failure in terms of the practical end, because it was the wrong target. See? So the heuresis process, the rhetoric, needs to think beyond the thing that I'm making, the artifact that I'm producing, the performance that I'm performing, to the goal that I'm trying to achieve.
And when we teach rhetoric, that's how we think about coming up with assignments as well. What function do I want my assignments to perform? Doing this well requires us to adopt a rhetorical identity, meaning we see ourselves as people who are setting out to discover opportunities for rhetorical learning on a day-to-day basis using the progymnosmata creatively. Let's finish up. In the bottom of the outline, make the distinction between microheuristics and macroheuristics. The macro heuristic is to see the entire collection of exercises from a distance, which, if my research is correct, places us, by analogy, at the end of the process, looking back, and in terms of the solar system, that's called the Kuiper Belt. Does anybody know about the Kuiper Belt? Yeah, that's where we are. Right? We're getting all the way at the end of it, seeing it all in terms of a collection. So if you look at your chart, you're saying, okay, this whole thing can be simplified, grammar, dialectic, rhetoric, and I see that whole flow all at once. That's the macro heuristic. How can I move within that flow in my day-to-day assignment creation? The micro heuristic, which in this case, if you look closely, is thinking creatively about how to teach the solar system by turning some of the planets into lollipops. See Saturn? I have the Saturn lollipop. It looks like it might be licorice today. How do I focus down onto that one exercise and make it work for me today, regardless of grade level? To apply it to my curriculum. So that's the micro heuristic. And again, this is another way of depicting my right-hand column. You see the flow of the trivium throughout the exercises. But you're also seeing, in terms of the micro heuristic, that you have opportunities to create assignments when you focus things down. So my caveat here before we finish is that I'm exhorting us to see opportunities for teaching rhetorically that cannot be taught in a conventional how-to lesson. I'm not giving you lesson plans. I've given you two examples of prompts that I wrote this week to try to show you how I'm working with this. But what I'm trying to do here is to try to infect you with something that's caught me, that it's a way of looking at the progymnosmata that then you can run with and come up with stuff that I can come up with. It's a lens to put between yourself and your assignments and your students. What I call the three micro heuristics, focusing down, are ways of looking at each of those different levels. So the first one shows us that the trivium is already present in the first three or four exercises. You see there that if my goal is to inculcate received wisdom and to move from there and teach the student how to write so that they can show they understand the grammar of a narrative, I'm already moving from grammar to dialectic, because the narrative exercise, even when it's taught to second graders, is embedded in dialectical sensitivity, because they're thinking about the elements of the story. Tell the story in reverse order. Tell the story back to me. Well, that means you need to know about order and arrangement. Or focus your story on the character, what they call characterization, when you're hearing. It's more dialectical sensitivity. And when we get to the triad, that eight-part formula, we're talking about the thesis through the seven blocks. So we've got grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric all up front in the first three or four exercises. Second collection moves us into dialectic proper. Notice that as soon as we get done inculcating wisdom, understanding it, and appropriating it, an argument,
we turn around and we test the truth of the things that we've been taught. We encourage the students to do them. And we all know that already with dialectic. And by the time we're done with dialectic, we've begun to recognize, as Sayers calls it, recognizing that a truth is true. Remember that in her essay? To realizing that truism is true, I think is the way she puts it. We're realizing that the kinds of virtues that are possessed of people are actually good, and we can present those in encomia and invectives and comparisons. So I'm trying to get you to see that even though this whole collection of exercises has a flow, they can be chopped up into these smaller parts. And then finally, the rhetorical part, the last four exercises, shows us that our goal, over on the right-hand side of the chart, has been, all along, to move from teaching students how to receive wisdom to perform wisdom as law. So the way that I talk about teaching rhetoric in the classical tradition, my classes to my students, is that you are born into a great conversation, which is the title of our humanities course at the Wilson Group, that a great conversation. You are born into a situation in which a conversation is already underway. Your job is to study so you can turn around and add to it. You have to win the right to write. You have to win the right to speak. And that's what this process is all about. To move from somebody who's taking in to somebody who's actually putting out. Forming, who's authoritative.
And so we see all of the elements of the trivium and indeed the goals of classical education itself in this phrase that I've been using since the start. The heuristic is the takeaway. I walk away thinking in terms of what I can see. So I call your attention to the other example in my pack, called the proverbial professional. Just to illustrate another example of how I'm using this method, trying to be creative with the progymnasium, in an upper school level writing and speaking prompt. Now the interesting thing about this, after you read the assignment, you'll figure out what this means, is that proverbs don't always agree with each other. One of our colleagues who's just published the first in a series of books for Classical Academic Press, Allison Barnes, has a whole list of these in one of her chapters. And she's got a lot of assignments that are out there. I'm a real big fan of Classical Academic Press. And so we look at these rival proverbs and try to figure out how to persuade, given the conflict among them. Well, I've set us up a situation in that assignment, and you know, it's kind of a fun situation that you place a student in where they have to adjudicate between these rival applications of proverbs and make a decision. But they're not just making a decision, they're actually proposing an authoritative law for future policy. So we're combining law with proverb and other exercises. So I give you these two examples just to encourage you to see that it's possible that I came up with these this week, and I plan on coming up with many more as I seek to finish this book. So to conclude, another quotation from our friend Quintilia, who says, the rhetoric, on the other hand, he's contrasting this with the Vetch shooter, which I am endeavoring to establish, and the ideal of which I have in my mind's eye, that rhetoric befits a good man, and it is, in a word, the only true rhetoric, will be a virtue. What I'm arguing today is that that virtue of seeing the opportunities to be creative with the given goods. By the way, this plant has another name. It's not just called crown veg. It's called pen gift. Isn't that interesting? Some people don't think of it as a gift, because apparently if you let it start growing, you'll never get control of it. It'll ruin your entire yard. But that's its name. We use the heuristics to receive the gift and turn this gift into something new. It's never been done before. And the 14 exercises are so provocative that I think they have unlimited potential in helping us to do that. We've got a couple minutes left. Questions?
observations, squeals of pain, outright.
Yes, thanks.
The work that I'm doing is going to err on the side of people who have connected to the cosmos. That's that concentrated rule, right? So if there are people here who say, wow, that, those Christian Gnostics, they look great. I wish I had started that in, at the age of five, but I haven't. My class is ninth grade. That's why I'm concentrating on it. I kind of get as a product. Well, they don't do that. So that's the reason. And the other reason is the stuff that I'm writing.
Well, I guess that public question, I think,
is
practical science.
There's
an assumption that somewhere is human as well.
Oh, yes,
yes. Particulars are
in
how I
would practice. So there would be a preliminary step to go to the formula and see how we got to get back to the question. So the ideal student in the assignment would be somebody who, you know, maybe got a little tired of the reputation confirmation, but trying to get excited. Excellent. Josiah.